I'm very happy to welcome here at McGill Yaakov Rapkin, who is an old and dear friend. And I believe the last time you spoke here was in about the year 2001, perhaps, after your book came out. What year did your book come out?
2004.
2004. It was about then. And a lot has happened since then. And that's one of the reasons I invited Yaakov to come back and tell us about what has happened since he last came here, because at that point, his very important book about Jewish opposition to Zionism had just been published, and it was unclear what the reaction might be or if there would be a reaction. At that point, it wasn't known to what extent the book would be read, what interest it would attract in the world. In any case, Yaakov Rapkin was born September 1945 in Leningrad in the Soviet Union. He's a professor of history at the University of Montreal, a historian of science, when I first encountered him. He earned his PhD at the Institute for the History of Science in the Soviet Academy of Sciences in Moscow in 1972, and after his emigration in 1973, he studied Judaism at religious institutions and in private sessions with Montreal, Baltimore, Paris, and Jerusalem. He told me recently that an encounter with a rabbi here on McGill campus was important in his spiritual evolution, which is something I hope he'll expand on a bit today. His publications have looked into the relationship between science, politics, science and totalitarianism, science and religion. But recently, he's often been invited to comment on international issues, including Middle Eastern conflict, printed in electronic media. His most recent book, and it's been translated in how many languages now, Yaakov?
10.
10 languages, is A Threat from Within, A Century of Jewish Opposition to Zionism. When that book was published in 2004, I recall discussing this, and the University of Laval Press published that book, and there was really a great deal of inquiet whether there would be any interest in the book at all or whether the book would be published at all, because it seems such an odd and marginal subject. But since then, Yaakov has become, as he said to me in a recent phone conversation, rather than a historian of science at the University of Montreal, he's evolved into a different person in a way. Chateaubriand says we have several lives laid end to end into a different person, where, as he mentioned to me the other day, he's become a public intellectual and feels he has responsibilities as a public intellectual. So without further ado, I introduce Yaakov, and I'd like to say to those of you who are not in my class, there are 8 students here who have studied Yaakov's career and writings and have written 5 pointers to be asked about his career and 5 questions. And Yaakov has observed and studied these pointers and questions and will be addressing these things today, I assume. He mentioned to me the other day, if he did justice to the students' points and questions, that this would be a slumber party, not just a simple evening session. So, Yaakov, please.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be back to your seminar. And the topic I chose today, that's the 3 countries in my life, allows me approximately 10 minutes per country, since my limit is 30 minutes, and I'll try to be reasonably disciplined. As you heard, I grew up in the Soviet Union until the age of 28, and these were obviously my formative years. And how can I describe those years? Well, I think that I grew up in Leningrad. It's a city of where history is really present, and both Soviet history and particularly pre-Soviet history. And I think that the Russian culture that surrounded me and made it very easy to identify with it. Looking back at my environment and asking a question I wouldn't ask at that time, it was a very multi-ethnic environment. I mean, my class friends whom I remember, primary school, there was a Ukrainian, there was an Armenian, I was Jewish, which is considered a nationality, was considered a nationality in the Soviet Union. So, and it really played practically no role. And I only looking back at it that I can ask this question, because at that time, these questions were just irrelevant, I think. Another important place in my life, which obviously school was, but also there was such a thing that called the Palace of Pioneers, which sounds very ideological. In fact, it was a club which was situated in a luxurious former princely palace, Anishkov Palace in Leningrad, where I participated in different after-class activities, one of them being study of the English language. So we were encouraged, it was late 50s, early 60s, late 50s more, we were encouraged to establish contacts with foreigners. Sometimes they would bring groups of American or British tourists to meet us. And in fact, we exchanged addresses, and one of them, we correspond to this day, by email these days. He has become a professor of chemical engineering at the University of Minnesota. That Palace of Pioneers really played an important role, and it enabled me to meet, to open up my horizons really tremendously. At the same time, this period was a period of de-Stalinization, when the old ideas of worshiping Stalin definitely were dethroned, where when what the history teacher would say yesterday was no longer true today, and no one knew what it would be tomorrow. So there was a lot of flux in the way political socialization was happening. And in the middle of all that, and I recall just as I was preparing this talk, that with my friends at school, we discussed various shortwave radio broadcasts that presented different views of the Hungarian uprising, which was the fall of 1956. At that time, I was 11 years old. Apparently, the socialization was very early, because I do remember distinctly these discussions we had. And, of course, they were not official. It was all done privately, but they did happen. And I think another thing that I took as a natural thing, but seeing my children grow up here, I could see that it is an important part. Difference was appreciated, was valued. There was no peer pressure to become like everyone else. There was a sort of state pressure to become like everyone else, but on the ground root level, there was really appreciation of being different. And no one was particularly afraid of being different. Of course, the Hungarian uprising and then later events made it very clear that Soviet Union, the society I grew up in, was severely restricting, straining political freedom, freedom of discussion, freedom of to read and write what I want. And for me, these were important and still are very important freedoms. And I think the last straw that I think changed my attitude was the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968 in August, when it emphasized for me that the Soviet society is not going to be reformed and I may not have a future there. And that's why, starting from that period, I decided that it would be a good idea to leave, except that this was a very difficult process. In 1968, it was practically unimaginable. But within a few years, it became a reality. I must say that I had a point of comparison. I spent a year as an exchange student in Cuba in 1966-67. And coming from the Soviet Union, I found the Cuban society at that time a real police state, ideologically controlled much more than Soviet society in which I'd grown up in. So this provided me with another aspect of how different socialist societies operate. Of course, Cuban socialism was a lot younger and therefore more enthusiastic. But it expressed itself in routine denunciations of friends and colleagues and stuff like that, that of course existed in the Soviet Union in the 20s, but I had no direct contact with this kind of behavior in the 70s or 60s. So this, it's the lack of freedoms that really prompted me to consider immigration, and a convenient way of emigrating, or actually the only way to emigrate, was to invoke my Jewish nationality, which at that time meant absolutely nothing to me. Well, actually, Jewish nationality doesn't mean much to me today either. But it didn't really register because my family spoke Russian and there was no religion, there was no, I would say, not even Jewish dishes in particular at home. So. But that was a pretext that was conveniently created by activists of the immigration, Jewish immigration movement, the Zionist immigration movement. And at that time in 1973, when I, well, in 72 I applied and then received an immigration visa, I arrived in Vienna, which was the transit point. And in Vienna, one had to declare whether one would go to North America or Australia or to go to Israel. And if one chose to go to any of these Western countries, one would be taken care of for a few months in Italy by, I suppose, international Jewish charities. And I have a certain aversion to being a charity case. So right there at the Vienna transit point, I said that I have no intention of settling in Israel, but I would go there because I don't want to be a charity case. So I'll stay a few months. And I remember I still am friendly with people who used to work there. They offered us coffee. I said, no, the coffee is for people who really want to settle in Israel. And I arrived in Israel in 1973 in the early summer without any, a transit point for myself. But I became interested in what was going on there. In fact, I didn't even want to take any loans, which were generously offered at the airport because everything at that time was arranged at the airport. So I said, no, I don't want to do that. Send me to a kibbutz. I'll work and eat, and I'll earn my upkeep this way. And indeed, I went to a kibbutz, which at that time I didn't know there were different ideological streams, and that one was a very left-wing kibbutz started by American Hashomer HaTzair movement Zionists. And they showed me, and they asked me, I spoke English. Many of them spoke English, so for them, it was one of the first encounters with a Soviet immigrant speaking English, and they were very enthusiastic. And my impressions of the Soviet Union didn't find grace in their eyes. It was very clear. And someone showed me later on the wall, there was a place where a picture used to be. You could see because it was different color. That's the picture where Stalin was hanging till 1956. When Stalin died in 53, the celebration of Purim, which is a holiday very much appropriate for the death of Stalin, was canceled because Stalin died, and that was inappropriate to celebrate any holiday on that day. So that's the kibbutz where I found myself. But I also traveled around the country a little bit. I was working whatever hours I was supposed to work, and within a few weeks, I sent my CV around the world, including University of Montreal, because through colleagues whom I had met at an international conference in Moscow, I knew there was an opening here at the University of Montreal, and since I spoke French, It was the asset, and still is, I suppose. I eventually got a position, an invitation to come to Montreal, and that's why I'm in Montreal. My impressions of, in Israel, I worked in the kibbutz. Then I was invited to work at, sounds very serious, at the Prime Minister's office, and with absorption of immigrant scientists, because I was a historian of science, and they were interested to devise policies how to integrate these scientists coming from various countries. So I worked there for a few months, and by the end of my stay, a war broke out, the so-called Yom Kippur War, during which I stayed there. I even volunteered to go to, well, it was a war, so I went to the military headquarters, whatever, and they sent me back home, so stay there. No, because I felt that the kind of small countries attacked by several countries around, it was appropriate to try to defend it. At the same time, Israeli society, of course, struck me that it was fascinating. It was very rude. And since I later went to Israel several times to spend a sabbatical there, and I learned the language eventually, starting at the Université de Montréal, of course, I became rather familiar with Israeli culture, which I appreciate to this day, and really I think that it's a fascinating society, which lives in, I think, in tragic circumstances. And I could quote one of my children. My daughter was 7 years old, and we arrived on one of the sabbaticals, and she saw soldiers in the street and says, "What are they all afraid of? Why are there so many guns?" And that's a question that, in fact, is still valid. And personally, I found, particularly during my sabbaticals, that I'd never lived in such ethnically segregated societies that Israel is. In other words, there were practically, except occasional waiter in the restaurant or a gardener, I just never saw any Arabs, because they just were not there where I was. Eventually, during my last sabbatical in Israel, I made an effort and gave seminars on history of science and science studies at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. And that was also an interesting experience. It's an interesting experience going there. It's located in Jerusalem, not far from the old city. And I lived in Western Jerusalem, so I called a cab, wanted to go to Al-Quds University. And the driver said, "No, I'm not going there." So I called another cab, and he didn't want to go. And I said, "Well, but Bibi, who was at that time, Benjamin Netanyahu, was the prime minister." I said, "But Bibi says it's a united eternal capital of Israel." He says, "Here's a phone, call Bibi, he'll take you." I think that's an interesting vignette that I think is still valid. But going back to 1973, I received my invitation from Université de Montréal. I arrived in a cold November, a cold November day, snowing. And I was met by department chairman at the Dorval Airport, taken to the university, whisked to the 8th floor, that's when where it was, and I saw my name on the door. So that's how I was integrated here. So in a way, it was difficult because I spoke, precisely because I spoke fluent French, and no one was aware that I was totally unfamiliar with Western university practices. So had I spoken with a heavy Russian accent, I think people would be just more aware of that, but they were not. And it was a very stressful period that I had to go through, preparing courses, applying for research grants. That was a new art that I was also learning. And also getting to know my environment. One interesting thing is that when I arrived here in Montreal, it was 1973, so the nationalism was rather present, particularly at the University of Montreal. And I found it perfectly comprehensible, understandable. In fact, the information I brought from the Soviet Union, the little I knew about Quebec and French-English problem, was sufficient to figure out what was going on around me. That really was surprised me in a way, because I had not been particularly interested in Canada when I lived in the Soviet Union, but apparently some of that information about foreign countries that people were very curious turned out to be useful. I had this information. Of course, I've read other things since. But the Quebec nationalism and the idea that countries can split up and countries can become something else, and the idea of ethnic definition of a state, this is some of the ideas that were around me all the time. And I think that it enabled me to formulate my own position. And I published, I remember, an article in response to article of actually former McGill professor Irwin Kotler and Ruth Weiss, both of them used to be here. They wrote an article very much anti something, comparing what's happening in Quebec with Berlin, 1933. And I wrote an article, I remember, in a Jewish magazine saying, Quebec 76 ain't Berlin 33. I think that was the beginning of my appearance in, as a public person. That was maybe one of the first articles that I published. I think that the intersection of different cultures, the political cultures in particular, becomes very clear in my experience in Canada, because I remember in 1990, I was called as a witness, expert witness, to the Commission for Foreign Affairs at the Parliament of Canada. And I was giving a talk. What was going then in the Soviet Union was early 1990. And my definition of it was there was a tremendous decentralization going on, and the Canadian government should have an interest in developing some kind of connections with other republics, except Moscow, where Canadian embassy is obviously located, because you never know how the restructuring of the Soviet Union may happen and may lead to definitely increasing powers of the republics and perhaps even independence of some republics. From that moment on, all the questions I received from parliamentarians were in French. No English parliamentarian would consider the idea that a state can disintegrate. All the questions after that were in French. And that showed me how perception of realities far from Canadian shores are colored by our own experience here. I must say that it was quite natural for me to also write an article later on the idea of transforming the state of Israel into a state where citizens would be equal in terms of Israel and the territories that were occupied in 67, into a state was called One State Solution. I remember publishing it first in Hebrew in 1998. And then a shorter version appeared here in English, because indeed the idea of a state was never particularly holy to me, either in the Soviet Union or elsewhere. So for me, it's a political structure that can be reshaped according to the needs of people who live there. And here in Canada as well, or here in Montreal more precisely, or as John mentioned, at McGill, I met a rabbi, Israel Hausman, blessed memory, with whom I started my exploration of Judaism, about which I knew practically nothing. This was a very formative period that we are talking about mid-70s, I suppose, when I became interested in Judaism, and little by little became an observant Jew, without anyone exercising any pressure on me, including Rabbi Hausman. He particularly exercised no pressure. In fact, when we met here, I was then perhaps more outspoken than I am today. I said, well, I read this code of Jewish law. How can an intelligent person possibly observe this stuff? And he said, well, you know, why don't you come after services every Wednesday morning and underline what you find ridiculous and superstitious and makes no sense, and we'll work through that. We'll try to explain. And I spent a year doing that. He never invited me to the services, which I think was a good thing, because I never felt obliged to go there. So, and then I met other people here, including many Moroccan Jews with whom I established very friendly relations. So in Canada, where by now I think I've spent most of my life, I've discovered many things. I've discovered Judaism. I've discovered very interesting fields of intellectual pursuit. It was not a drastic transformation from one field to another, because I studied science and culture. Then I studied science and Jewish culture and Islamic culture. And from then I went to contemporary Jewish history. So it was not abrupt change, so to speak. So while I'm speaking about three countries, I've lived also in others. I mentioned Cuba, where I lived practically for a year, and where I learned Spanish, and it served me well, because I later married a Mexican, so I can speak with my mother-in-law in her language. I also used the resources of Montreal, including McGill, to learn other languages. I learned Hebrew, began learning it at the Université de Montréal with Jean Ouellette. I studied Aramaic here with Barry Levy. And I think that the liberal values, the freedoms we enjoy here in this society, continue to be very dear to me, which I don't take for granted. I think they are remarkable, and without any particular declaration of love, because I don't declare love to states, I think the society here, whatever the government may be, still is very decent, very open, and enables an individual to flourish and develop. And what else can we ask for? Thank you, John.
Well, Jacob was very observant of the guidelines to set off a discussion in a concise half hour. So I'd ask everyone here, our norms are to normally have a discussion for, say, 45 minutes afterwards, and you could ask anything at all that you'd like, as some people are more familiar with Jacob's life and work than others, but please feel free to ask anything at all that might interest you about anything Jacob said or things that he didn't mention in his talk.
Where did you learn to speak French so well?
I studied at the University of Leningrad. I began my first 2 years at the University of Leningrad were at the Department of Turkish History, History of Turkey. And the first year we studied Turkish, contemporary Turkish, which is written in Latin alphabet. And the second year, we were to study Ottoman Turkish, which is written in Arabic characters. And the teacher said, you better learn French because the best dictionaries from Ottoman are in French. You learn French. Also, but it's, I remember it was a time of very intense cultural exchanges. So there were a lot of French singers, you know, Barbara and Jacques Brel, who's Belgian actually, Yves Montand, of course, and others. There was a Comédie Française playing. So there was a lot of presence of French culture, not the same French culture that used to be spoken in the Salon of St. Petersburg in the 19th century, to which most probably I wouldn't be admitted anyway. But it was around us. So that I always tell my children, you never know what you learn for. I learned it to be able to use Ottoman dictionaries. Well, turned out to be useful.
If I could ask you something, Jan, about the origins, intellectual or spiritual, of this book about Jewish opposition to Zionism, I mean, I'd be interested in knowing if you are writing an autobiography about what engendered this book. That's to say, I know in my own field of French history, people who write on fascism, for example, or on important issues like that, often when they write their autobiographies, will say it's personal experiences, it's meeting people, it's seeing things, rather than in a library reading room that engendered the line of reflection that led to this particular book. And I'm interested in hearing you talk about that. And also, another dimension I didn't quite hear, perhaps I'm being very naive about, is about God. I mean, did you believe in God did you suddenly believe in God? Or I mean, were you a functional atheist and suddenly you had a sense of God? I mean, was there a sort of conversion experience in your life in that area? Or is it consistency? Or... In other words, what I'm really teasing out of you here is autobiographical themes that interest us in our course.
Yeah. Well, I think that my interest was essentially my interest in discovering Judaism. I'm answering your second question first. Has to do with the total ignorance that I had about things Jewish. I knew nothing whatsoever when I lived in the Soviet Union. It was an entry in my internal documents that I'm Jewish, but I didn't know anything about it. It pretty much was the same as the color of my eyes. I mean, I can do nothing about it, but it doesn't have a special meaning. So when I settled here in Montreal, and particularly it was when I was in a I was teaching for a semester as an exchange professor at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. I started attending a few courses at the Baltimore Hebrew College, and I read books. I started reading books, and one of the books, in fact, was a book by Jacob Katz, Out of the Ghetto, about Western European Jews. And that book, in fact, explained to me that what defined Jews throughout centuries was some kind of a relationship with Torah and commandments, with Judaism, so to speak. And that's from then that I started my exploration, because I realized that I didn't have any connection and I didn't have any attitude. I didn't have negative or positive. You know, for example, I remember an interview on the radio with the widow of David Ben-Gurion, who's the founder of the State of Israel, and she was asked about all kinds of things on the radio, and one of the questions was, does she eat kosher? She says, of course not. And then the interviewer said, well, but in Tel Aviv, at that time in the 70s, it's difficult to find non-kosher food. No, but I buy a chicken and I soak it in milk, which is forbidden, of course, according to Jewish law. But in other words, she had a relationship. I had none. So I started studying, and there was no sudden revelation. Nothing happened. I just had the awareness that this kind of knowledge has a normative value for me. Because if I'm Jewish, I'm supposed to be doing these things. And very slowly, again, there was no overnight conversion. Very slowly, I began the practice and this awareness that I think I had throughout, that we have to bear responsibilities for what we do, a responsibility that perhaps goes beyond our immediate circle. So that's how I grew into more observant Jewish life. I think the discovery of God, so to speak, I don't think it would be fair to describe it this way. It's a very different process. Even in the Soviet Union, I was interested in occasionally religious issues, but in the Russian culture, religious issues mean Russian Orthodox issues. And in fact, I remember reading some stuff about Russian Orthodoxy. And the only time I think I was in a synagogue in Leningrad with a non-Jewish friend of mine at the university said that there's some Jewish holiday and that it's fun and we should go. He took me there. And in fact, it was fun. That's about my becoming observant Jew, which is not exactly how you phrased the question, but how I'm answering it. Now, the book came from that interest in Judaism and my interest as well in my observations, my experiences in Israel, which where I found Jews from day one of my arrival in 73, very different from the Jews I had known in the Soviet Union. And later I found them very different from the Jews I knew here in Montreal. So I became very interested in Israeli society, and I forced my children to learn contemporary Hebrew, and they all speak fluent Hebrew and all that, because I think it is a very important part of today's contemporary Jewish history. At the same time, I saw those differences. So when I was studying during my sabbatical, I spent time studying at various Jewish institutions in Jerusalem. One of the them, Rabbi Horowitz at the what's called Jerusalem Academy of Jewish Studies, set up a group about issues of Zionism and Judaism. And then I was doing at that time also programs, radio programs for CBC and the Voice of America in Russian. And one of the people I interviewed in 1981, I remember distinctly, was the head of the anti-Zionist group, Moshe Hirsch, who was at that time totally bizarre phenomenon for me. But I was interested even then. And then it wasn't an issue that I was particularly interested in. Again, during another sabbatical, I was in a very Zionist institution in Jerusalem, Beit Morashah, where they had a seminar on what in English would sound ultra-Orthodox anti-Zionist thought. So I spent a few months there actually delving into the texts, speeches, and books. And again, it was for my own interest. Finally, I never thought of writing about it. And then when I was here in 2001, there was a demonstration of anti-Zionist Jews here in Montreal, and I got several phone calls from the radio and Radio Canada, and said, Yaakov, what is this phenomenon? And so I explained in one article and another article. And then, as it so happens, the director of the Presse Université Laval had an appointment with me, and he said that he had followed my career and he would like me to write about something. And I said, you know, if you want me to write about something, here's a topic. It took him a while to understand it because it sounded like I'm going to write about how to boil snow. Doesn't quite make much sense. But eventually he he accepted, we signed a contract, and nothing prompts you better to write a book than a signed contract.
You didn't know anything about Judaism. Was that just because you're living in the USSR and they don't, so your parents weren't allowed to teach you, or were they believers in Judaism?
No. To the extent I can ascertain, I remember there was no mentioning of anything. I do have some early childhood memories of my grandmother, who didn't explain anything to me either, but I apparently was just judging because how from the perspective of the table that I saw, so I was looking from below, so I must be about 4 or 5. I remember that she was doing what today I understand. She was baking matzah at home because it was before Passover, and then it was not available commercially in the Soviet Union. So I think that she was observant. Again, I think. But she never said anything to me. She never taught me anything. So either because it wasn't, either because dangerous possibility, or because since my parents no longer were doing anything Jewish, she thought it would be useless to do it. I don't know. I can't penetrate her mind. That's why. And moreover, in the Soviet Union, Jewish is nationality. And that means that nationality is not a normative concept. See, you can be Ukrainian and not drink gorilka and you're still Ukrainian. or you can be Frenchman without eating baguette and you're still French. But it's only many, many years later I realized that Jewish identity is a normative identity. It's not just that you have the color of your eyes, but you do something, or you don't do something. My answer. So in early childhood, I just don't remember anything. And again, my first visit to the synagogue was, I might have been then 21, 22. And again, I remember Sasha Vorontsov from a very aristocratic Russian family took me there.
How did you research it exactly, and if you encountered any setbacks during your research? I mean, did you ask for some help from rabbis, or did you take on most of the work yourself?
Well, when I suggested this topic to the publisher, by that time I'd accumulated a few files of materials that I collected in my previous seminars in Jerusalem. And I just had my little collection of materials, which I didn't think I would use one day. I used those. Then I had to work. There is a sort of a fundamental anti-Zionist text of Yoel Moshe by the Satmar Rebbe, which is written in a language that, to understand it, I really needed help. So I went to the Satmar Hasidic community in Utrumon, and the man agreed kindly to sit with me and explain to me the passages that I didn't quite get. And then there, practically all materials were available. They're printed materials. And I complemented these with a few interviews. When I had things pretty much ready, I went to see anti-Zionist groups in Jerusalem, in New York, and there's one to the north of Montreal in Saint Agathe. So, and I think I spoke with someone in Antwerp. It's mostly based on written materials, which are widely available and not so difficult, and on a few interviews.
Yeah. Don't have any question, maybe I can ask one.
Yeah.
Your description of the of Leningrad society in which you were growing up as a child and youth gives a different impression than what is usually considered to be not just repressive but also anti-Western and limiting contacts with West, with Western people. And you're talking that you were encouraged to not only learn the language, languages were learned, but to have personal contact with people. How do you explain that? Is it just a false impression that is in the literature, or is Leningrad a bit different, or is your school milieu different, or how do you explain that?
Well, it didn't happen in school. It happened at this after-school activities at the Palace of Pioneers, which I mentioned was a luxurious palace and a good place to parade Western tourists to show how Soviet children have access to culture and languages and all that. So I think it had certain propaganda value, obviously. At the same time, they did encourage us to have pen pals at that time. That's how it was called. And I still have letters that I wrote. My friend from Minnesota gave me copies of those letters. I think that it was de-Stalinization period. You know, we're talking about 57, 59. It was still Khrushchev time. I think things started changing after Khrushchev, after 1964. There was room for local initiative at that time to do these things. But independently of all that, there were all these French singers and the Royal Vic Theater, and they were all coming. I didn't dream them. They were all there. So, in fact, as you know, translations of Western literature were very common and very widely done. So I think that it was a contradictory period because we were all aware, I was aware, of the lack of freedom. That is definitely true. Lack of freedom to discuss, lack of freedom to read, particularly. But these were openings, and a particularly important factor that I think encouraged me to study languages was the availability of shortwave radios. So if you know the languages, you can understand what's going on in the world. And that's why it
was a no-no also.
Huh? Of course it was a no-no, of course. But everyone did it.
Did you say that the difference between Leningrad and, say, Tula?
Never lived in Tula, I don't know. I never lived in Tula, but of course Leningrad was never appreciated by governments in the Soviet Union. As a result, now they have an entirely St. Petersburg government in Moscow. But I think that there was an interplay between prohibitions and what people really did in practice. For example, in the Soviet Union, you could easily, very easily, much easier than here, buy a shortwave radio. And one would wonder, wouldn't it be more logical to forbid them, not to produce them? There's complete control of the market, so is there easy to forbid? And yet they didn't do it. So I think there was a curiosity about the West. There was a certain opening towards the West. And I think the Soviet Union was never sort of as paranoically closed as North Korea, for example, is today. They were concerned about Western opinion. They were concerned about exchanges. They needed scientific exchanges. I wrote a whole book about it. So they had to compromise their instinct for control with their need for openness. That's all I can say. I don't know how people lived in Tula. In fact, I can say that when I read Putin's memoirs, and Putin is slightly younger than I am, what, 10 years younger? And he lived within 10 minutes walk from where I lived in Leningrad. Completely different universe. There's nothing in common. You know, for him to serve in the KGB was, at the age of 15, he went there, volunteered, and they sent him back to school, of course. But that was something which was important, to serve the country in this way. In my environment, and again, it wasn't chosen, it wasn't a private school, it wasn't anything special. It was a regular school. But just to give you a feeling, because I think that story is important. One of our sort of school friends, when we grew up, and after the school, was recruited to the Soviet Army, which is obligatory, but since I went to university, I didn't have to. And he was the only one, actually, from our small group who went to the Army. And he came back after a year. It's a three-year service. We had, of course, a party and drinking and eating. And about half an hour before the stores closed in the Soviet Union, someone said, well, do we need more booze? And, of course, the answer wasn't the affirmative. Therefore, we had to collect money. And by that time, we changed chairs many times as parties developed. So the friend who came from the Army says, why don't you reach the left pocket in my jacket and take the money? And I reached the left pocket, and I produced the party card. Silence. Everyone fell silent completely. And this friend started apologizing, saying, you know, in the Army in Germany, he was serving in Germany, there's so much pressure on us, and he felt very uncomfortable. No one had said a word, just silence. But that shows how even membership in the Communist Party was viewed in this particular circle. Incidentally, he later was living in complete cognitive dissonance between his beliefs and his party membership, and became an alcoholic. And just a tragic story, a very common one too. So, hope I answered you.
Socialism in Israel as opposed to the Soviet Union?
Well, I knew nothing about kibbutz. I knew it existed and people worked and ate, and there was no money, so it exchanged within the kibbutz. That much I did know, and that's why I chose to live there, not because of any ideological commitment. If anything, I was rather skeptical of socialism after spending 28 years in the Soviet Union. I found very little resemblance between Soviet experience and the kibbutz, except the picture of place where a picture of Stalin used to be, and some of the opinions I heard from kibbutz members, particularly veteran members who went to Israel in the 30s. So I think my aversion to even the word socialism was way too strong at that time to even consider those minute differences that might exist. So I was just not interested and not aware either. But I didn't see kibbutz as a continuation of the Soviet experience. No, it was something different. One important difference, you could leave it. Yeah.
One of the things that I really respect about your very latest book that you wrote in 2004 is the fact that you're taking on a bit of a touchy subject, especially if we consider the cases of Stephen Waldman, Hirschheimer, who's commented on your book, and Norman Finkelstein. Do you still see opposition, or were you aware of the opposition beforehand, and is your passion, let's say, for history and your religion going to make you continue your more historical studies into the things that you've launched yourself into?
Well, I think that that book sensitized me to the issue of European ethnic nationalism. And I'm now interested in some issues involved with changes that have happened in Europe since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the emergence of ethnic nationalism, not only in Eastern Europe, but sort of rehabilitation of that in Western Europe as well. So this is something which I'm tentatively exploring at this moment. As far as the book itself is concerned, well, I've lived with it for 5 years now, 6 years, because it has come out in different languages, some of which I know. Therefore, I revised and complemented and changed and reshaped. Well, happily now that comes the Japanese edition, I can do nothing about it. But just today I received the Hebrew version coming out in Israel, so I'm working on that. I think I've changed the books from the French original. There are a few changes that happened, and I think a few mistakes were corrected, because obviously there were some. But the the fact that it's a touchy subject, in fact, when I was writing it, I wasn't aware of it. Because I do remember that the word tenure, the concept of tenure, was introduced to protect political ideas, not to guarantee employment. Even though in French it's permanence d'emploi, but still I remember what it was introduced for. And therefore, I think it's my obligation to touch on subjects that some people may find objectionable. I wasn't aware of that till really the book came out, because it did provoke some opposition to the opposition. Some of it was pretty violent. I was surprised. And there were attempts, I don't know how successful they were, just to silence it. For example, when it came out in French, I was interviewed on Radio-Canada, Le Devoir, La Presse. Then the English version made it to the short list of Governor General Awards. And there's only one newspaper that has never mentioned my book, Canadian Jewish News. So sometimes it's in there. But I'm fine. You know, Globe and Mail mentioned it, Gazette mentioned it. I'm fine. Jerusalem Post published my articles. Haaretz interviewed me. So I don't feel neglected. But there is a certain taboo because comparison that I could make, it's in the Soviet Union, if some scientists become dissidents, well, you can explain it as vestiges of capitalist past and bourgeois elements. But when workers become anti-Soviet, this is totally intolerable. Because the workers are supposed to be united around the Soviet cause, right? So that's a little bit like here. Jews are supposed to be united around the cause. And here I'm writing a whole book about people who, from day one till today, oppose it. Which I think is perfectly natural. Any political revolution provokes opposition. There's nothing new. But I think for many people, for many Jews, and I think for many Christians as well, Israel and Zionism have acquired a religious connotation, and therefore to write about this, about opposition to Zionism, even though I think the tone of the book is certainly not militant, the very fact that one raises this question and says that the Israel and Zionism do not represent all Jews, whereas in the Soviet version, proletarians of all the countries unite. So they have to be united around this idea of workers' socialism. So I think there's a parallel. And the way some people reacted also reminded me of the Soviet Union. And this is very strange. I don't think there is another issue in our contemporary life that is as touchy, that can cost you a job, or can cost you, as the issue of Zionism in Israel. I only discovered it later, but I think there's something unhealthy about it. I think you can be pro-Quebec nationalism, against Quebec nationalism, you can be pro-America, anti-American, there are all kinds of variations that you can be perfectly fine. But on this issue, and I hear it all the time, it's a delicate issue, it's a delicate, it's très délicat. And I don't know why it's délicat. It's a country, it's a strong country, and Israel has no reason to be so sensitive about it, just any other country. But for some reason it has become so, and I think my book and some of my articles have clarified the situation for many people. Because the confusion of Judaism and Zionism is in fact dangerous, as confusion of any religion with political structures. Here in Quebec, you know, la langue et la gardienne de la foi. Now we know these connections.
You just mentioned that confusion, and I presume that idea I wanted to ask you was whether contemporary Hebrew played a role in that confusion, or the emergence of contemporary Hebrew, and maybe, I guess, less of importance in Yiddish in Europe, for example. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, well, I can answer in a very professorial way, so in my second chapter in my book is devoted to this question,
but I'll answer nonetheless. I think the emergence of modern Hebrew, or the invention of it, so to speak, was a very emotional political vocation for some people, including the founder of modern Hebrew, Perelman, who became Ben Yehuda. It enabled the Zionist movement to establish apparent historical links with the past, even though very often the traditional Hebrew meaning of the word was completely changed. And just one example that I give in my book is the word bitachon in Hebrew means trust, and usually in traditional Jewish sources it's used as a trust in God, you know, in providence. Well, this word today, Misrad HaBitachon, is a ministry of defense. So it changed the meaning completely. And I think that enabled a new society to be shaped by the founders of the Zionist movement, because they really were shaping an East European national society. That's what they were doing. They were very intolerant of Yiddish, extremely intolerant of Yiddish. In fact, when the founder, Perelman Ben Yehuda, when his mother arrived in Jerusalem to visit him or to settle there, he refused to speak Yiddish with her, and she didn't know any Hebrew, obviously. That's the fanatic attitude, I think, that enabled this language to develop. And actually an Australian Israeli academic, Gilad Zuckerman, with whom I've been in contact, he wrote a book which in Hebrew is called Israelit Safa Yafa, Israeli is a nice language, in which he tries to prove that it's in fact not a Semitic language, but an Indo-European language based on Yiddish syntax using Hebrew words. Again, I'm not a linguist, I cannot judge it, but it is part of the history, part of several books that question this new identity. The book by Shlomo Sand, which is now available in English, The Invention of the Jewish People, that where he treats this whole idea, and my book that shows that Zionism has been a revolution against Jewish continuity, in fact. So all of these works that have been coming out in the last 20, 15 years, I think show that in a way the emergence of Israeli society was largely helped by this new language. Well, I think that today it's a normal language. It has become a perfectly normal language. Traditionally, Hebrew was referred to as Loshon HaKodesh, holy language. And a rabbi from Strasbourg was visiting here recently, and he says, what makes it holy? What makes a language holy? And he said that Maimonides, he quotes a medieval philosopher and rabbi, Maimonides said that language becomes holy because there is no word for sexual relations. You have to go through euphemism. And he said that that's exactly what, if you look at the Bible, all kinds, and Abram knew Sarah, and all kinds of ways of expressing it. But then he added, and today, go to the Tel Aviv bus station, you could see that language is no longer holy. Oh, that's too bad. Which you read. I think that this example just illustrates what you asked me about.
Do you think you would have or could have discovered Judaism in the Soviet Union or Israel, or was there something unique about Canada that facilitated that?
Well, I could have done it anywhere, but I think Canada, or Montreal to be more specific, makes you aware of your identity. And I think that was a facilitating factor. It doesn't explain everything, but I think it definitely was a facilitating factor, because you cannot, well, Montreal is largely about identities. The question that I asked myself, what it meant to be Jewish, I think emerged rather naturally here in Montreal, but it could have emerged in anywhere else, I think. So I cannot, I'm not determinist to that extent. Yeah?
So speaking of identity, for a number of my friends, after their one of the most sort of significant experiences for them in sort of establishing their Jewish identity was going, was traveling to Israel and traveling to Jerusalem and so forth. Do your anti-Zionist opinions sort of negate that process as being important? Do you think it's not necessarily important for young Jewish people to travel to Israel?
The anti-Zionist opinions about which I've written my book. See, the formulation is a little bit different. consider that these programs, in fact, are propaganda operations, including the birthright, which enables, the word, if you think of it, birthright, that any Jew in the world, young Jew, can go on a free trip to concentration camps in Poland and then to Israel, and then they're asked what do they like better. It's a very powerful experience for many people, and one of my daughters was a guide monitor in this group, so I know it firsthand. I think for many people, Israel is the second largest Jewish concentration in the world after the United States, and therefore and they're very important Jewish educational institutions. So for some Jews, they may discover Judaism. For others, they may discover Zionism, which is not the same thing. Some may feel that their Jewish identity now is to support Israel, right or wrong. That's their identity. And I think that's these programs tend to develop that more than interest in Judaism itself. Just like Joan mentioned, people write about fascism, but it doesn't mean they're fascist, right?
Yeah, can I ask you about several, since they didn't ask you this just now, but in their things that they wrote, several people raised the issue of why would you pursue a line of inquiry or a line of writing, a line of scholarship that leads to so much grief, in a sense. I mean, you run into a lot of, you run into hostility, you run into people who don't understand, and people ask you, well, basically, why do this? I mean, do you do it fundamentally because, well, this is, you've done an intellectual research, and this you think is the truth, and this should be established as a historical truth? Or is there a spiritual dimension to this where you arrive at a conviction that, other people may think you're wrong, but you're absolutely convinced personally that your way of living and being Jewish is the correct way, in spite of the fact many other people would see you as someone who's has a nefarious effect on the Jewish project or something like that?
Well, you know, if I have to make a balance sheet of reactions to my writings, they're overwhelmingly positive, including from Jews. I'm very often complimented by people. I receive many emails. We talk more about sort of violent critique, but never, see, no one has, to the best of my knowledge, no one has shown that there is a mistake on page 24 or 75 or that I misrepresent something. The usual critique that this book has engendered was we shouldn't talk about it in public because we are surrounded by enemies. But this really touches a very raw nerve. You know, I grew up in a society which told me, never criticize the Soviet regime because we are surrounded by imperialist enemies. I know this by heart. And that's why this argument carries absolutely no weight for me. Not only doesn't carry any weight, but it provokes me. And I think that many people, Jews and non-Jews, have learn something from this. And the fact that it's translated in so many languages, including Japanese, it shows that this question interests many people. Because for many people, Jews and Zionists and Israelis, it's all sort of confused in one entity. And then they read the Bible and they read, you know, about Jewish philosophy or Jewish morality, and then they see something on the TV screens and the two don't quite match, and they don't quite know why they don't match. And now they've read my book and they see that they shouldn't match. In fact, there's no reason to expect them to match because they come from different sources, they pursue different goals, and it would be wrong, in fact, to assess any state of the 200 states of members of the United Nations according to some religious doctrine. So that's... when I was writing it, I don't think I was doing anything provocative or that would... But in fact, I've counted 23 lectures on this subject in Japan.
In Japan?
Yeah. Now, why would people be interested? I think I've exhausted the Japanese audience by now. But why? Because it interests people. They really want to know. Or, for example, even more relevant issue, I published one chapter of my book on use of force. It's the fourth chapter in my book, Use of Force in Jewish Tradition and Zionist Practice. And I published it as an article in the Jewish magazine in California, Tikkun, in May 2006. And then in September 2006, I received a magazine in Arabic with a translation of my article into Arabic. And it then dawned on me that someone in the summer of 2006 in Beirut was translating an article explaining differences between Jewish attitudes towards the use of force and Zionist attitudes, while literally bombs were falling on Beirut. It was during the war in Lebanon. So I was very moved that someone found enough of curiosity and integrity to do this. It was so easy to say for him that these are Jewish bombs falling on him, right? It wasn't difficult to figure that out. But he, or she, whoever translated it, apparently found it important to explain the differences. And I think that there is a role that my talks and my articles, my book, have played explaining these differences to very diverse audiences. Once again, Zionism is no worse than any other political doctrine, as far as I'm concerned. And Israel is certainly by far not the worst state in the world that misbehaves with respect to other people. I think it's wrong to confuse the two. That's all I want to say. So when you don't judge Israel as, according to some religious criteria, you therefore say, well, it's a political state, it has its own logic, it has its own raison d'etat, and that's the way they function. Nothing more, nothing less. And I think that's what many people have appreciated. Yes? Yeah.
Have you had an experience of being called anti-Semitic by Zionists?
Not yet. Not yet. No.
No.
Oh, well, whether I had experienced anti-Semitism, because
yes,
that's
sorry.
Not the same thing.
Yes, sorry, have you? Yeah.
Well, the first time I was called a dirty Jew was in Brooklyn in the 70s when I was taking a break from those Jewish holidays, and I was taking a break from the services, and I went with a friend and to some local park, and someone made this comment to me, but I'd never been sort of insulted this way before. Perhaps it's because of my size. People just didn't want to mess up with me. But I really didn't. I knew, and I was very much aware of anti-Semitism, which used to be official in the Soviet Union in, say, early 50s. That was my father lost a job, another perturbation in my family life. And I knew when I was growing up in the Soviet Union that the hurdles I'd have to overcome would be a bit higher than for other people. But you take it as an actual phenomenon, more or less.
I kept Jacob longer than he was told he had to respond.
No, if there are any more questions, I'll be happy.
I get your signal. Since the book was published in 2004, I remember vividly when we launched it from Gangola BLE or something. And
are you there?
Yes, and people were, I thought the police would come, people were screaming at me. And I didn't know if this was going to continue. I remember there was a great deal of violent reaction to you personally.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering how that is at all. I mean, do you find that there's more debate about your ideas, civilized debate about your ideas, or is there a level of ad hominem, personal animosity that remains the same? How do you feel about the evolution of, say, putting your theses on the table so that they can be discussed in a civilized way without provoking anger and resentment, and I get especially the ad hominem charges.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the reactions to my book and to my other writings have fomented optimism in me, because by far the most violent and unpleasant experience was the one that you witnessed
at the beginning.
And I've never had anything like that again.
Is that so?
Anything like that again. Just to give you one example, I mentioned it briefly. When my book came out in French, it was reviewed by a Jerusalem-based French-language magazine, Jewish magazine. When it came out in English, it was reviewed by Jerusalem Post, which is a right-wing Zionist newspaper. Then they had an interview with me, a very positive interview. And then I published an article in Jerusalem Post to which the editors gave a title which I hadn't given, because I'm soft-spoken. The problem is Zionism. And there was an article about constant violence around Israel and in Israel, and that's the title they gave to my article, but the problem is Zionism. And that's Jerusalem Post. So I think that the reaction at Olivieri here in Montreal was truly exceptional. I know that people here in Montreal are aware of this, and some of them remember them, and one of the detractors even published an article afterwards and circulated it widely on the internet. So it creates the impression that that's the normal reaction. Well, it hasn't been happily. Mm-hmm. I was recently in Kiev, and I gave a talk at a university, at the Kiev-Mohyla University there. And I was about to leave the following morning. But in the morning, I went to the synagogue, observant Jew, and people asked me where I'm from and what I was doing. And I told them my book had just come out in Russian and that's how I was presenting it. Oh, say, great, fantastic. Why don't you speak at the synagogue? And so Saturday night I spoke to the synagogue, presented the book, and they bought all the copies that were left. Actually, some of the people were quite knowledgeable. By their questions, I could tell that they had studied those sources. So, in fact, there's nothing particularly new for people who are reasonably well versed in Judaism. It's people who really are more ignorant, and particularly who have a tendency to worship states. For them, it's a bit of a problem. But again, I'm not at all. I will see how the Hebrew edition is going to be reviewed in Israel. Yes, there were some incidents sort of in Ireland, and there were a few incidents that people were unhappy about my talking about it, but neither was the content corrected and shown incorrect, nor was I sort of verbally assaulted the way I was in Olivier. However, When I was presenting the French book at the Maison du Canada in Paris, and there were about 100 people, wonderful, great. And afterwards, someone called me to the window and showed me the three gendarmes standing on bicycles. So I came down to the gendarmes, said, "Bonjour, monsieur." Say, "What do I owe this honor?" I says, "Are you the speaker?" I say, "Yes, I'm the speaker." "Well, we're not going to reveal our sources, but we thought our presence here would help you." In other words, it's not a coincidence that France and Montreal that are on the same information wavelength as far as Jews are concerned, and those were French-speaking Jews, if you remember, that they tend to be, some of them tend to be rather violent. And they're sometimes verbally violent, sometimes beyond that. So I'm very grateful to the Gendarmerie Française that they came. You never know. But otherwise, it's not. But within the meeting, there was nothing wrong. I mean, it all went perfectly fine. And I presented it in Strasbourg and, you know, even, well, just, I was, the Russian edition of my book, when I saw the actual copy, it says, supported by Avichai Foundation. I'd never heard of this. No one had asked me about it, but it's on the first page. So I looked up what is Avichai Foundation and Googled it, and it turned out it's a foundation devoted to Zionist education and the diaspora. So apparently for many Zionists, it's also important to understand why their movement is opposed so much, so which makes perfect sense to me. So I think there is a more measured reaction among people who are really interested in the issue. And what you saw in Olivieri happily has been an exceptional experience.
Does anyone else have any questions?
One last question. Great. Thanks so much.
Well, I'd like to thank Yaakov very much. And I hope he takes encouragement from this to continue writing his autobiography, which I hope very much that he will produce, because I think it's quite a témoignage how a scholar can pursue what he thinks is and what he finds to be the truth, and the results can be, we see in the end, encouraging for all of us. So thank you very much.